Okay, I'm talking to Derek DeKirchhoff again. We're continuing our series on what is a democracy, what are we voting for, what happens when you have all kinds of media environments, and you're supposed to focus on one particular character for a president or for a local politician issue. And we ended off with a dialectic. Derek said, there's the media, which is serious reporting, news, or maybe press conferences on the White House, versus the abundant entertainment media, which he calls cinema. Cinema versus the media was what we were working on. So, Derek,
yes.
Do you want to develop that a little more?
Yes, because I think, and it's surprising, but when you look into it carefully, you can see why. It's a medium of choice now for social protest. It's a medium of choice for institutional. You can attack. And as a real mark of democracy continuing, at least in the North American continent, and some part of Europe too, you can actually criticize governments by using fiction. And you can do it in such a way that you get so close to the bone that it's as if you were telling the you will make the journalistic story of it. So that's the medium of choice because, of course, it addresses a lot of people. It is sensational every time. I mean, it's really good story material. And it does get a great deal of attention and also requires a great deal of attention. Otherwise, if you're going to make something like House of Cards, you really have to know how the government, plays behind the scenes, so to speak. And it's not... Or Inside Job. Take Inside Job, which is a very courageous foray into the collusion between governments and big business. The democratic part of this is the fact that it's tolerated. But people get, executed in other countries for half that criticism. I mean, what it is recently, I don't think... Somebody either was killed or at least was thrown into prison for having made a criticism of Erdogan in Turkey.
Mm.
Just an example. I mean, there are tons of examples of absolutely people are, their voices are literally muzzled. And this is not the case. And what I'm saying, cinema is, in many American themes and series, is intensely surveying the process of democracy or the capacity or the breaches to democracy that we are all experiencing. And I think this is very important. It's a form of criticism that really hits people. It tells stories. And I don't think it would be very interesting if we could have somebody totally objective, prove that, in fact, it was or it was not the case. In other words, that government really didn't behave so badly, that there really wasn't between the NRA and God knows what Republican group any kind of agreement or accord, So I like it. I like it very much. I'm very grateful for the fact that it's possible that we can actually share into that and figure out, And it's, our confidence in institutions and governments beyond shaking. Shaken, I mean, it's like lost.
Yeah. Okay, let me respond. When the printing press came in, people had the chance to read and to write, to publish locally in little newspapers and pamphlets. That the expression of your opinion in paper had never happened before. And so then that seemed to be the pleasure of this new print-based environment. Being able
yes,
to...
but guess what? Why do you think Holland became so rich? It printed everything that was actually forbidden in the other countries.
That's right, but
so
that's not my point.
Okay,
I'm talking about the pleasure of seeing yourself. McLuhan said the printed book allowed people to see their national language, their vernacular, and that that's
yeah,
a kind of a pleasurable mirror. So we set up this thing where people, this institution called democracy, where people can express their opinion and be critical or supportive, all those things. Now, that's 300 years ago. So we move along, you get to 100 years ago, and then people have telephones, There's all kinds of newspapers. There's all levels of seriousness in the newspapers. There's movies. There's all this media where people can express themselves. But they still valued the printing press. They still valued the what was said there, and that you would mark a ballot and have an influence, and you would be allowed to be critical. Now that people have so many media to express themselves, to the pleasure of stating your opinion in an election is so puny compared to the pleasure of publishing yourself, your own diary, all that you do in Web 2.0, that I can't see what's significant about being critical anymore on just this political level about who's going to represent you. It seems to be puny compared to all the things that one can write and criticize and be silly about, or be extra academic, all kinds of levels of response. There's different forms for that. Why would I stop to say, okay, that particular guy, yes, he should work in that office there. So what is the why does it linger?
It lingers because it's the actual reduction of all what you said to a single yes-no response, because it's a lot easier to handle people who are obliged to a limited series of choices to arrive at a yes or no, vote yes or not vote, than actually managing the different agendas of absolutely everybody. And this is exactly why this is happening. And that's why it lingers on. But I think there may be in the future some sort of, you know, with big data and with sensors of all kinds, there may be in the future a system that simply susses out whereabouts. You know, it's like huge. What was the name of the thing in Brave New World? Soma. Yeah.
Yes.
You're all into Soma. It's a huge Soma sensor.
Yeah.
Grabs everybody and manages everybody's egos, desires, wants, you know, in such way that they somehow manage to harmonize the whole thing. Like music, we talked about that before.
Yes.
So we may have politics as music. That'd be lovely. But I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon. If you see what
Okay. So, what was the point you start off making right there? What was the first point?
The first point was the idea that that there is a reduction of all,
oh, yes, that's
of
what
all
I got
people's
it.
Agenda into
yeah.
a single set of yes-no choices that are, you know, end up into giving top power to a hierarchy.
No, I got what I want to say.
And other people like that at the top.
I was talking to somebody. He said the reason you have phenomena like the Harry Potter books is that people, especially Westerners, literate Westerners who value uniformity, they got all this media coming at them, and they're throwing media out. They want to have a centralized image, maybe for their children. So everybody agrees that Harry Potter is an important meme, and so everybody buys it. It might happen in a movie, but there's a centralizing tendency that the population puts on, and that centralizing factor may be why every 4 years they say, yes, let's all get down to a simple statement, yes, no, whether we want this person or not. That's that what we call the Harry Potter unifying syndrome. That would be the role of elections now. You see? And you say you want to reduce. I say that's what's happening in the whatever is a big fad.
No, I didn't say I wanted to reduce. What I said was that if a politics if some sort of political order that we can call democratic is using that particular political representation coming down to a vote or a set of votes, but I mean all sets of votes are also hierarchical and lead to the president or to the director, that is one way by which is very linear, very traditionally hierarchical, very categorical. All of that comes along with the tradition that it was established by. Democracy was a literate product, and it still is. But the point that I'm trying to say is that if we move into a politics or at least an association between the people and the order, the state of things, I see as a possibility that that order would be infinitely more tactile than abstract.
Yeah.
Much more sensual than abstract. You know, we are moving away from abstraction, I think, although we are moving into new abstractions.
Yeah, there's a difference. There's right hemisphere.
An abstraction too.
There's right hemisphere abstraction and left hemisphere brain-wise abstraction. Two kinds of abstraction Marshall had on his chart. So then What was I going to say there? Okay, carry on. I forgot what I was going to say.
Me too, but we can carry on anyway.
Yeah.
No, the problem about...
I now remember. Once you start talking, I remember. Do you think McLuhan's distinctions still apply? That you have acoustic tribal people who aren't interested in freedom of expression that comes from 200 or 300 years of literate training. McLuhan said a literate society takes many years to form, to sink in. So over in other parts of the world, they take the word, the spoken word, seriously. And if you say something negative about the government or the emperor or whatever, you get killed.
Right.
Do you just think those distinctions happen? He said, you know, the literate people has a neutral eye. He has a dimmed-down acoustic sensitivity. He's not as volatile as acoustic societies are. And you can get killed easily, and it's not seen as a problem in more tribal societies. Those distinctions that he made, do they still apply?
Yes, I think so. Yeah. I think that cold-blooded killing and then using the media to show it off simply bears that. It goes on absolutely. And the tribal thing overcomes entirely the association of an identity, me, and another identity, the guy I'm, cutting the throat off.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that the tribal versus the emotional tribal, mythical, steeped into superstition and God knows what, this is absolutely going on. And so and the rest, the guy who are the so-called civilized, are still going on too. So no, we are schizophrenically involved in a situation right now. It's large. It's global schizophrenia, and it's going to have to be resolved because all schizophrenias we've known before have been resolved.
Right. So the do you think when the Chinese come over here and go to universities and put on the literate world, and they're really good at it, they're really good students and that stuff, those cliches, those stereotypes, do you think they are becoming literate the way the Westerner became literate? Are they ever going to get out of their tribal mind and become a literate individual?
That's a very interesting question. I've asked it myself, and I'm just trying to figure out whether or not. Yeah, I'm just thinking about the number of Chinese people I have met or Japanese people I have met, or Korean for that matter.
Yeah.
And if I had to make, strangely enough, now you make me think about it, I do have the experience both of Japanese and of Korean and of the difference, something different about them in many ways, but I mean in styles, in, of course, the language. But that is one big one. The Korean are much more capable of putting on both the literate culture and their preceding culture, more so than the Japanese. Very strange. Japanese
now, did you have a Korean or Japanese writer in the Point of Being book?
Yeah, two of them.
Yeah, I remember seeing the names.
Two of them.
That's who
and
you're thinking
so
of.
We were very interested in their sort of, idea of what we meant by touch. And
right.
I think they were very helpful. And, the idea that it's all based on the middle, the whole. It's very interesting, the Chinese and the Korean, who actually... Chinese borrowed a lot from the Korean, apparently.
Have you heard, I've seen people confront Bob Logan, Asians, and say the Korean had a pretty close to a phonetic alphabet, way back there. Have you ever heard that argument?
But it's not way back there. It is true. Hangul was created in the, Hangul was created by a priest, a missionary.
Oh.
Who I think it was a bit like what happened among the Inuits of Canada. There was a writing. The writing was invented for Inuits by a missionary back in the 19th century, and I think Hangul much earlier than that, because you can sort of date the change of Korean culture from the time the alphabet was introduced. And it's very interesting.
You mean the Hangul alphabet?
Hangul is a very it's not complicated, it's very complex. Why? Because it keeps the square format or space that the Chinese system had, right?
It's
much later than Chinese. So what it does, now what happens, First of all, you have to know that Hangul is a polysyllabic system, which means that it is not based on simple syllables, you know, words as syllables or concatenation thereof. It's very interesting. Hanyong Hapshimnika means thank you, or hello, I can't remember which one.
Yeah.
Hamsa Hamnida is thank you, and Hanyong Hapshimnika is how are you. It's not at all like Chinese or Yihao, you know,
yeah.
Oh, I'm a, these are very different. So that's the reason.
Could that
why,
be why the Koreans have a bit of left hemisphere going, that they can do?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
The Koreans are inventors. They have been inventors from the start. They taught the Japanese and they taught the Chinese.
Mm.
It's absolutely, it's a case in point, a cultural case in point, that would take me, you know, 10 years of devotion to make.
Yeah.
But it's one of the things McLuhan wants to simply just hop over. He would say, well, of course. And he would move on to this, something else.
That's right.
Yeah.
Okay.
But
so,
it's true.
All right. So you have this good question about how much is the West going east and putting on the east, and how much is the east putting on the West, this put-on factor. I think McLuhan would say that we can't have the literate thing take over in the East because there's too many post-literate media going on. The only reason they do put on, the Chinese put on the West, is it's an identity crisis. There's too much tactility in the, say, in Web 2.0 or even in the television environment the last 20, 30 years that enhances their innate tactility. And apparently cultures don't like that. So they don't like their own sensory system being enhanced, their own bias being enhanced. And we don't like tactility for other reasons, so we put – no, we don't like the – well, I don't know what we don't like. We know that we're a basket case now because our visual bias doesn't apply anymore, so we are groping around looking for something that we can replace it with. So we go southern, western, eastern. We put on these other modalities, which I don't think Americans are doing anymore. They did it with the baby boomers and Generation X, but somehow there's a fundamentalism where Americans now love being kinetically biased and fake literate, semi-literate with their Bibles, and they're sticking to it. And meanwhile, the other cultures are maybe a phase back, and they're sort of trying out the literate as a put-on because they think they have to. So you have a lot of complexities of the pattern that McLuhan laid out. And remember, he got that from Finnegan's Wake. The West shall shake the East awake, and East shall have the night for morn.
Yeah.
You know, that great quote.
All I have to do is take a plane to discover that.
Yeah. Okay, so I think that those demarcations by McLuhan don't apply anymore. You like to use the term tribal. I think there's a fragmentation going on so hyper that we're creating more than schizophrenia. You're creating what I call quadrophenia, incredible ranges of emotions and aberration of thinking and passions that aren't measured in any standard way anymore. That's why when they interview people and they don't know where's Tennessee, what is that, a capital city? They don't have any visual markings. And then the literate professors get all upset that the American people don't know their visual parameters anymore. But those parameters don't apply. And we may be seeing that in this election. There's a whole new kind of emotion going on.
Yeah.
And the journalists and the old values that people project on this, even the Electoral College, they're shocked at something different happening in the population. And we don't know how much that's going to translate into, say, tribal identities or ethnic identities. Because every kind of person who's supporting Trump, they're not limited to their national identity, other than the Mexicans, apparently, right? They're outraged. And have you heard of the incredible violent demonstrations going on in California in the past week?
No, tell me.
A friend of mine, son went to it, and they couldn't get in the stadium for Trump. It was sold out or filled up. So they wanted to be part of the action. These were young business guys in the financial world, and they like Trump. So they sat in a restaurant nearby the stadium. But the protest intensity of those hating Trump outside, and they seemed to be Spanish or Mexican, because when the cops started to get worried about them, they had to speak to them in Spanish. It was the only way they would listen. And they were telling me, get back, step back. But my friend's son and her buddies got scared. It got so passionate. Now, they're sort of semi-literate guys, and they were shocked at the intensity, the passion of the protesters, and also that the signs were basically swearing. So the crudity that these people perceived shocked the Westerners or the literate Americans. These are literate guys who have, you know, pretty good financial marketing jobs. So the intensity around Trump, and I don't know if it's happening at the Bernie Sanders rallies, but it frightens people what is going on in the mania by those that hate Trump.
It's astounding. I never had. I knew there was some scuffle in there and here.
But you hadn't heard what I said.
No.
Yeah.
Not at all.
And the police were telling them to back off in English, and they saw it wasn't working. It wasn't until they started speaking Spanish to the protesters that they kind of calmed down. But basically, it never worked. It just remained a noisy news item. It made the news, and it was all over the media. They were covering it all day long. This is down in San Diego or someplace like that. So there's a new kind of emotion going on, a new kind of fear. Now, these financial guys, they do not wear their Trump T-shirts at work because those that are against Trump confront them at work and feel justified that, you know, Trump's a fascist and you shouldn't be reporting them. So you've got now people – I don't know how widespread it is, but it is true for this person in his 20s. They have to go stealth in what they're going to vote for. Now, that's a new kind of intensity.
It is, for sure.
Now, isn't that, though, getting like Jamaica? Remember, when they used to, I don't know if they do it this year, but remember in the 80s and 90s in Jamaica, there'd be dead bodies all over the place when they had an election?
I remember, yes.
Yeah, I don't know if that's still going on, but that's the tribal person who's inflamed with the group mind, and they get mad at other groups. You know, Nelson Mandela could not organize once he took over the country. He couldn't get it into a semi-literate sensibility because everybody was so devoted and loyal to their tribes that he couldn't stop the tribal warfare. See, okay, so you get all that kind of noise going on. Are we supposed to just say, hope this balances out over the next 50 years? Are we supposed to be concerned?
Well, no. I would say, first of all, we're supposed to pay attention and find out what's really happening is what you and I are trying to do.
Yes.
But, okay.
Yeah.
That's the very first thing, because it's not an easy job to really figure out, and a lot of people don't stop to try to figure out. They simply go into action, and that's exactly what we want to prevent.
Yeah, and
or
don't you think the way when you bring in McLuhan knowledge or talking figure ground, it's like the new taboo. People do not want to think about it because it's too complicated. It's too threatening of what's going on in the present. Have you noticed that as being the director of the McLuhan Center, the ignoring of the issues that you would want to bring up? I've noticed that. People, remember McLuhan said that people do not want to know about figure ground media analysis because it threatened their privacy. Sense of privacy. You remember that?
No, that I don't remember. It's interesting thoughts. So tell me more about that.
Okay, in the letters, it's in the 70s, he said, I finally figured out why people don't want to look at media ecology. He says, for the literate Westerner, it's a threat to their sense of privacy, their private identity, that they are being molded by environmental factors around them. They really get insulted by it. It's a threat to their identity. And he says, I figured out why I can't get any traction in my knowledge or get any people taking me seriously because the Western literate person, his identity is threatened, his privacy is threatened by media knowledge.
Yeah, you can see why that reaction would be pretty common. Yes, absolutely. But then a lot of that is semi-conscious.
Yes.
So
no. People don't know it
quite instinctively. Yeah. They don't. They don't really know what's going on.
They just. They don't know why. They don't. They would say, "No, I don't. I don't disagree with Marshall on that level. I just think he's wrong. You know, or something." You know, people still read books. I mean, he said books are gone because they never paid attention to his definition of obsolescence was that there'd be more book reading.
Yeah.
It's interesting how McLuhan came on in the 60s as a manipulative satirist and reversed all the meanings. What people, like he would say, we're not a visual society, whereas the ordinary perception in the 60s, 70s was visuality was increasing. That meant photographs, advertising, color. And they thought that's what he meant by visuality. No, he meant black and white, very limited perspective. Now, did he satirically purposely confuse people? He knew what they would think of as visual space, but he said, no, it's this. And he flipped the meanings, he even flips the time-space traditional meanings in criticism 100 years ago. That backfired on him. It got so mixed up. And I can see in a slower society in the 60s, he's going to want to make people think. So he reversed the meanings of the terms, like saying the books are obsolete. Nobody noticed that he meant that there would be more of them. Okay, so he, you know, mischievously flipped things to make people think. But the issue of making people think was irrelevant by the 70s because everybody was already thinking about everything because they were all having an identity crisis. It was usually a worrying kind of thinking, but people didn't think in the 50s and 60s the way they thought in the 80s and 90s, where people are reading reviews and commenting as much as possible and getting apathetic until the internet came in. Then they got very expressive. So the ground for his manipulative satire, if I'm right, had changed, and therefore he didn't have to be a manipulative satirist anymore. People could understand what he's saying. Obviously, technologies change us. But his language was all screwed up. And you still go to conferences around McLuhan and still arguing over hot and cool. And Eric said, look, we just meant that for the next 6 months. It wasn't something we'd stick to. You ever hear Eric say that?
No. I'm delighted that you made that point. That makes me laugh about Eric. I think that's great.
Yeah,
that's
no,
great
it's even in some of the letters. Marshall, he would create a dialectic just to have something to stimulate people. But then people would get bogged down for 20 years trying to figure out what's a cliche, what's an archetype, you know, or what's hot and what's cool. And so it backfired on that level. So I don't see McLuhan's language being useful today.
Mm.
I like Croker's language. Mm. Did you ever read Arthur Croker?
I have. I read the virtual class, all the stuff about that, but it was a long time ago.
Right, okay.
Arthur is a wonderful writer. He really is.
Yes.
He writes for intellectuals.
That's right.
He doesn't write for the general public. He's not. That's his public is very very restricted. So it is high level. Of course it is.
All right.
But
so
it requires high level readers.
Right. Now he would not. He would criticize McLuhan inaccurately in his books in the 90s. That's the way to say it. Inaccurately, he said that McLuhan was part of the emergent philosophers, and he would say he wouldn't understand the violence that McLuhan meant in the society. Croker coming from the Marxist world, the social protest world, thought McLuhan was a bit too Catholic or something. Okay, that's what he's doing 20 years ago. In his latest book called Exits to the Posthuman Future, he actually is forced to talk about McLuhan the way he wouldn't in the 90s. And actually, I think that's why a lot of the left media liked him, because he sounded like McLuhan, but he didn't talk about McLuhan and he didn't support McLuhan, it seemed. All right? So look what happens.
That's true. He always was ambiguous about it. Yeah.
Yes.
Sure.
Well, now he has to write a whole chapter about it. And in this book, Chapter 11, Thinking the Future with Marshall McLuhan, Technologies of Abandonment, Inertia, Disappearance, and Substitution. Now, I never heard Croker ever talk about the tetrad. So guess what? In this book, he has invented what he calls the dark tetrad. He says the tetrad doesn't work. Now, listen to this, and I don't know any McLuhanites or people like yourself or Logan who study McLuhan, know McLuhan's work. You don't know what Croker has done, and this book came out in 2014. So look what he says. For example, and this is page 176 if anybody wants to look it up. For example, McLuhan's justifiably famous concept, see, he says the word concept of the tetrad also has a dark side. a hauntological dimension. That's his term, H-A-U-N-T.
Hauntological. Not bad. That's good.
Do you know that word in other contexts?
Hauntological?
Yeah. Did he make that up?
Of course he made that up. It's very good. It's actually, he could have picked it up from Joyce, but it's pretty cool.
All right. The hauntological dimension. So he says, to paraphrase the performance artist Laurie Anderson, the tetrad also travels now at the speed of darkness. And that's in quote. Viewed in reverse mirror image, the tetrad reveals not only what has been gained, but also what has been lost with the realization of the technological destiny to which the regime of computation delivers us. On its positive transformative side, the tetrad reveals the four laws of social media to be our very own data flesh. What's enhanced, what's retrieved, what's rendered obsolete, what's intensified to the point of reversal with every major technological innovation. So he lays out the traditional definition of the tetrad. Then he says, however, viewed in mirror image on the side of what is disowned, prohibited, and excluded by new technological media of communication, the tetrad has another story to tell, and here's what it is. You take the enhancement point that a new technology enhances something that's in the human being. He goes, not what is enhanced, but what has disappeared by every technological innovation. Then he takes the point of what's retrieved. Not what is retrieved, but what is abandoned by the fast technological recycling of the natural and social worlds. Not what is obsolesced, but what has been effectively substituted for that which has disappeared. So obsolescence is a substitution. Not what is reversed, but just the opposite. What is held in place, immobilized, almost cryogenically frozen with the appearance of every new technological media of communication. So what do you think of that? He's rewritten the tetrad for the dark side.
Yeah. Frankly, I'd have to really give it a better thought. My first reaction is not to be extremely convinced because, for example, the one about substitution, I don't see anything dark about it. I just see it as putting the same thing in different words. I don't see a reversal, in other words.
Right. Not what is obsolete, but what has been effectively substituted for that which has disappeared. So he's saying, now this is true, we move so fast that what is enhanced only lasts like 10 seconds because there's so many other patterns that come in. So nothing actually gets to be a present. We don't have a present anymore. We can't arrive at the present, is my instant theory as I think about this. There is no now. We're too busy getting canceled and erased by data abundance. So it's interesting. Nothing gets enhanced now. It just gets disappeared. And then if you're going to retrieve something, no, it's abandoned. and since you can't obsolesce what never got in.
The first one is cool. I agree. It is a dark side. But it's everybody, I mean, you didn't need a tetrad to do that, but it's very cool.
All right.
What happens, the disappearance is that when omnipresence is equal to disappearance. That's what it is. If you want to enhance, you focus the attention. It's a hypnotism and all that. Yeah, I get that. Second one I don't go for. Third one, retrieval. I remember.
No, third one. Listen to this. Not what is obsolete, but what has been effectively substituted. Because something has disappeared, there's something that comes in right away, replaces it. That's a substitution, and it's happening so fast, we don't know whether it was obsolete before or not. I think that's what he's trying to say. Anything replaces. Then that substitution gets disappeared. And then there's something that's held in place, immobilized. There's something stable, and he's calling that the reverse phase, but he's calling it the opposite. Mm-hmm. All right, now let me just – where the paragraph explains this after he lays that out. He goes, when the tetrad moves at the speed of darkness, what is shut down is the eye of perception that is fundamental to ethical reflection on the future of technology. What substitutes for the closing of the eye of perception is the sightless vision of all the machinery of guided perception of information culture. What has been abandoned as so much galactic digital debris by the twin drives of computation and genomics are those post-human bodies in endless, aimless drift as they circulate through the fast loops of cybernetic information. And what is held in place, immobilized, is an increasingly specious present, there's that non-present, increasingly specious present that is in equal measure deeply nostalgic for a lost modernism and for the stripping down of just about everything else to accommodate the laws of efficiency, connectivity, transparency, and speed that is at the heart of what Hannah Arendt called the negative being of technological society. a technological destiny that can be so deeply seductive because it contains a tangible, palpable scent of a death drive in hypermotion. Pretty good. I think that that complicated talk, once you know how to interpret it, is way better than anything McLuhan wrote. It's more up to date. It's more modern.
That's right. It's worth getting back into it. And I like the fact of that book. I didn't know about it, so I'll get it. I'm here in Canada, so I can actually buy it somewhere.
Yeah, Exits to the Post-Human Future. All right. So I just wanted to bring that in just to point out the ideas which are valuable, but this is where I'm finding that McLuhan's language doesn't hold up. It's too slow. The dialectics are too limited. It's just based on the sensory apparatus. That's why I brought in my four-body, five-body model. We got to talk about bodies. And Croker does, before this book, he does one called Body Drift. He's right on the same page as me. He says we're dealing with multiplex body, weird simulated apparatus that are floating around. That's our environment. So then, in that situation, the chemical body vote for a chemical body to go sit in the White House for 4 years in that bubble in that prison and supposed to make chemical body decisions is so irrelevant. And so I guess what I'm trying to say is that I understand where the frustration and therefore the passionate involvement of people is caused by the lack of proper language, appropriate language, by the so-called authorities in various media outlets, or like the New York Times. Their editorials are weak. They don't even know McLuhan stuff. If they do, like that article on minimalism I sent you, how Trump and Sanders are minimalists, he quotes some very general statement by McLuhan that's not even really relevant to the issue. You'd find better quotes if they looked into Croker. But again, I guess they write the newspapers for people in grade eight. The thing is, people are getting so involved in the highest decibels of information and consciousness that the administrations, the bureaucracies, can't keep up where the people are today. They're in a very sense of cloned ESP. Do you know that I've seen a couple of TV shows over the last 5 years showing youth culture, just kids in high school? They always, when something happens, they say, well, that's like the Good Wife. They refer to media images. Wants to take someone out on a date, they refer to some movie fad about someone taking a famous one about dating. Everything is translated into some MySpace media archive terms. You see what I'm saying? In other words, the kids, they can't even, they got to go to the prom in senior year. They've got all these movies like Carrie and whatever that one was in the 70s. They have all these movies that they refer to. Their chemical body doesn't live it. And so if someone asks someone for a date, they got to be very careful that they're not a cliche replay of some movie that all the teens know about. Are you getting what I'm saying? That they translate themselves through media imagery of everything they do.
Mm-hmm.
So they're hyper self-conscious.
Yes, they are, but it's that they're building their virtual self.
Yes, okay, I agree with that.
And the point is, literacy brought that up as well. The only thing is that the virtual self is outside the body, whereas the literate self is inside.
Or you could say outside. Literate space is an external hardware situation, and the interior landscape that people are swimming all the time digitally, the tactile, might be considered more interior, but, you know, we could quibble over it. There are differences between the literate fantasy life and the chip body fantasy life.
Mm-hmm. It's true. But the fact is that now what we call consciousness and awareness is different. What we call, at least what we call the content of consciousness, or what we imagine the content of consciousness to be, is now being externalized, and we spend more time with the externalized variety than the internal one.
That's right.
This is a big sort of slippage out. And then not only that, we can't just talk about a single profile or a single thing that you build, and even less about all the profiles that are built about you that you don't know. So,
Would you say Lacan's mirror stage doesn't apply anymore? You know Lacan, the French
psychologist? Yeah, I do. I'm trying to figure out it doesn't. I mean, it was still, you would still have to define, you'd still have to have a moment, a mirror moment in order to define an entity and limit it. In fact, if anything, what you call a digital native doesn't go through a mirror phase.
Right.
Doesn't need one.
You know what you wrote in 1984 in your New York Times editor op-ed on the value of the nuclear bomb? Do you remember saying this? Harold Innes went circles around Marx and McLuhan went circles around Freud. You remember saying that?
Yes.
That was a good statement. And I would apply McLuhan to showing the weakness of Lacan's psychology, though those postmodernist gangsters over there, who's the one who, the woman who, Philippe Soller's wife, who did a lot of that work, Kristeva. Yeah, take people like that that really built up an intellectual identity around Lacan and what he was saying and then would develop new ideas beyond that. Their whole thesis falls apart now if they'd known more McLuhan or more de Kirchhoff.
One of the interesting aspects of the people who were connected in some fashion with, or rather that actually impressed McLuhan among the French, for I think McLuhan wasn't that impressed in general with anything to do with Marxism. He used to laugh at it, but I think he was impressed by Foucault, and I remember him being interested in Foucault being an archaeologist of knowledge and an archaeologist of sensibility. He was, I think, impressed by the fact that Foucault said that the idea of the human person was a recent invention and destined to a very, very soon demise.
Yes, that's
but all that in all seriousness in the archaeology of knowledge. So Marshall he wasn't as easily scoffing them out as he would. We had a kind of, an offhand way of dismissing the French intellectuals. But that one, no. He didn't.
Well, he quoted that. Do you know where he quoted that? In his foreword to Subliminal Seduction by Wilson Key or whatever that guy's name was.
Key. Oh, really? What did? How interesting.
Yeah, if you have a copy, look it up. Subliminal Seduction, it's a really good foreword by McLuhan. And he basically explains what Key is seeing. Key seeing all these embedded images here and there. And McLuhan said, well, this is perfectly logical because if you hype up sexuality, you've got to have complementary violent images. They go together, sex and violence. And so he said it's natural that they would put these death images in there as well as sexual images. They had to put both in. So,
I remember that.
Yeah, he actually explained – I don't think Key ever realized it. He answers the pondering of Key about this situation. But he quotes Foucault, and I'm pretty sure it's the archaeology of knowledge in the essay, in the foreword.
Excellent. I have to look into that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the only guy he ever quoted. I mean, he may have written a letter or two about Derrida. In Gordon's book, he says Derrida is a Manichean satirist in academia.
We actually went together to listen to Derrida and saw him after the conference when he came to Toronto.
What, you and McLuhan did?
Yeah.
Wow, that's pretty unique. You should talk. What happened?
We went up to say hello. And then they had a chat, which was difficult to hear because people were thronging, as always.
Where he was.
And I just remember, I'm trying to remember exactly how I put it. It's funny because it's true, it happened, and I never bothered to write it down. But
what year was this? Is this after 73?
Yes.
Because he spoke, and Don Thiel always quoted... he gave a talk in 71 in Montreal someplace, and that's where he really criticized McLuhan and had McLuhan all – he did McLuhan – like I'm saying McLuhan reversed the terms. He reversed the terms in his criticizing of McLuhan. He took McLuhan backwards and then made his position, contrary to that. Now, I bet you McLuhan didn't know that, and he may not have ever read Derrida, and maybe because he saw him with you, that was an oral presentation, that intrigued him, and he started reading him, and then he made the declaration that he was a Manichean academic. So it'd be interesting, what year did that happen?
Yeah.
Has the Tetrad come out? That comes out in 74 in little pamphlets he was making. I'm going to say things that trigger you. Is it after you do the Virilio scene where he sleeps on the floor? At the party?
Yes, it would be. Wait a minute. Yes. No. I'm really vague on it. Let me just, I'll get it back.
Yeah, we can go back to that.
We can go back to that.
Leave that open. Because it's really, I've never heard anybody, I talked to a guy who was Foucault's main buddy in New York 10 years ago. Spent a lot of time with Foucault, and I said, did he ever talk about McLuhan? No. I don't think I ever heard him mention McLuhan, which is interesting in light of what you're saying McLuhan appreciated Foucault.
Mm-hmm.
But Foucault had no interest in McLuhan.
No, I don't think he did. Foucault was – I actually had a very strange moment with Foucault myself.
But you told us about that. That's on our tape.
That I don't want to repeat it, but it was about identity. I've had strange conversations with Foucault and with Derrida, and all of them around precisely where McLuhan would have stood on my side and where they didn't even know what I was talking about.
That's right. You were representing McLuhan's meme, and it did not compute.
But let me be indiscreet, dear Bob, because you are now saying that McLuhan's kaput, and overrun by Croker, which I think would be a wonderful thing because we need to update all these things all the time.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, you've got a huge capital out there that's being devaluated.
I know, I agree. If people are just arriving at McLuhan's doorstep. And so this is between you and me, our criticism, but I always use McLuhan among people who don't have much education or haven't been in an education scene for 30 years. They have, they're not fine-tuned like we are. We're talking, thinking, reading all the time, right? They're just going on doing whatever their roles are, and they're not thinking all the time. I find McLuhan is surprising to them, shocking, interesting. I still use McLuhan for the layman, let's say. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But
that corresponds to me as well, as opposed to Croker, for example, because we don't write for the same publics.
That's right.
Yeah,
Croker
yeah.
is actually a McLuhanite infiltrating the Marxist world, and his buddy David Cook, who was a teacher at University of Toronto. He got Croker. He told me personally back in 98 or something, 97. When Bruce had his conference at York University in March 97. Croker came and spoke at it, but David Cook was there, and I got to talk to him for a while. Actually, we ended up staying overnight at his place, Carol and I did. But he told me that he got Croker interested in the French thinkers at some point in the 70s, and they decided to enter that semiotex world of Severo Lestrange and what was coming out with Baudrillard and them as a representative of the Canadian media history. So that's why his book in 1984, Innes, Grant, and McLuhan, is a Canadian entrance into it. Now, he had to be going after that leftist world or anarchist world. He can't talk about McLuhan. They're not going to have it. So he fakes his criticism of McLuhan. And so therefore, he's acceptable in the left media. And I sometimes wondered if he had did that on purpose. I'm not sure. But the way he's talking about McLuhan now... maybe he did. He was a double agent, but he's still not going with the simple McLuhan jargon. He's enhancing it and developing what he calls the dark tetrad.
But you see now the difference between McLuhan. Precisely, there's light and dark here, because the difference between McLuhan is a very sunny character.
Yeah.
Fundamentally, and good old Arthur, and God bless him. He's not a sunny character.
Right, he's grim. He's grim.
Very grim. I love him so for it. But frankly, he doesn't look like he's enjoying himself very much.
That's right, right.
And you can't reproach that to him. It wouldn't be fair. But the fact remains that there is a certain kind of... first of all, there's a big moralistic approach, which, of course, McLuhan wanted to stay away from.
Yes.
And of course, everybody jumps on McLuhan's head because they say, well, yeah, but you didn't have to bother being moralist. It was all in your Catholicism, right? So whatever you write is... So there's no question that there was something there very maybe surreptitious, let's say. But on the side of Croker, he is critical, which is what academics and intellectuals want, of course. But then he goes, he's critical in a way that sort of leads into. An us against them kind of you're obliged, you're sort of forced into an us against them kind of relationship, whereas in the McLuhan world, no, you basically are forced to look at where you're putting your foot.
Zingroni, he told me around that time in 97 that he says, note that Arthur was a seminarian. And then he dropped that, and he got into the left world, and he's still applying that Jesuit morality, whatever it is, to his new world, his secular world, non-religious sensibility. He still has the critical morality, or I don't know what you call it, superiority complex.
No. That is something that I thought for a long time, that there had been, in his education, a very strong sense of right and wrong, and one that would dominate pretty well any judgment of any sort, including aesthetic. And so, that would be. But then, of course, when he brings that, when he brings the rigor of that approach, and of the education, if he was really a Jesuit, then he would have had a tremendous rigor, because Jesuits do. And then he would then... greet the rigor of Marx, because Marx was very rigorous in his analysis. And he would greet that as, you know, a perfect model, which would then eventually influence his mind by the content as well as the model, if you see what I'm saying. He would be, and he would realize that it was closer, if indeed, to the left wing and to the various protests. But you see, when I was talking about cinema being a medium of choice for protest, that's where, again, we're very different. You can protest all you want by being left-wing in critical stuff and in intellectual writing. That's not where the majority is ever going to be finding out about you or finding about the way you protest.
Yeah.
Whereas if you do it on film, bingo, you got audience of millions.
Right. So do you ever notice in the... investigation into the JFK world, there's hundreds of books by all these critics of the Warren Commission. It wasn't until The American Sought in movie form with Oliver Stone about 1991 in JFK that they got so riled up they changed the legislation on it and got the documents released early because it was in the right medium. It was in a movie.
That's my point.
Yeah.
Absolutely. No, this is the case. And I don't know. Let's not be exclusive here. I feel very important that particular critical approach continues. I'm not applying it myself, but I feel it's important it be done, because it will eventually filter upwards towards the big moguls of cinema, you know, production.
Yeah.
It'll eventually get to the public without the complexity, because the public simply can't handle that much.
Right.
And so it's. I think the world. I feel like Pangloss here. I feel the world is well made in that sense.
Right, but remember, don't use the word public. That's a literate world.
Oh dear.
Remember how McLuhan would not use the word. What is mass man? That's what he said we were living with mass man, not a public.
That's right.
So when I put on that hat, that's something I would tell some layman. They were going on about the public. I said, well, you know, the public doesn't exist. And you tell them the structure of the literate public and how that's not what's happening. If you do it well, they immediately get it. That's right. We don't have publics, people with points of view. It's a different kind of participation, which he called mass man. And McLuhan said mass man was not a tribal person. Did you ever hear that?
No.
Yeah. How I explain it is you had the increasing autonomy that we now know as a matrix tube, like you see in the movie The Matrix. Everybody ends up in their own little virtual bubble. So the decentralization of a uniform consciousness on that level by the digital technology is part of the mass experience. So you have increasing tribal or instinctive involvement in the now, but it's balanced off by your fragmented way of taking in information, like beginning with the VCR. You didn't have to listen to the news or the show or Ed Sullivan at the same time. So you have increasing fragmentation plus increasing merger into a one kind of zone. The interplay of the autonomy and the merged zone is tactile. Mm-hmm. That's what mass man is. Mm. So that's pretty good. You've never heard that spelled out, right?
No, I didn't. No, that's very interesting. So tactility would be mass man.
It's the interplay of opposites. Mm. McLuhan says in 1974 that we're both centralizing and decentralizing, and that's really important to understand that. But now put it into digital where it's brought down to you in your little iPod world. You're putting on the mass consciousness of tribalism. That's what I call the TV body. But your chip body is flying like an astral body all over the place, super angel. And the interplay of your TV body and your chip body, that's a tactile interplay. So tactility is not in one medium. It is the interplay of different media dynamics. That's the new tactility. See, TV was a tactile medium, but the global theater that the satellite brought in was the interplay of TV, radio, magazines, books, and all the media and bulldozers and oil companies. That's a huge environment of tactility. So you see what I'm saying? TV per se is a tactile medium, but the interplay of all the media is a new kind of tactility squared, and that's the tactility nobody talks about.
Mm-hmm. It's very interesting. Yeah, I think requires the next... Our next tome in The Point of Being.
Yes, Point of Being Squared.
Absolutely. No, it's true. It would be worth exploring in detail, because in a way, my intuition pushes me in that direction when we talk about democracy, to come back to the
yes.
topic.
Let's try to find the tactility in democracy as I've defined it. Let's see if try it.
I don't see an obstacle to that. I would see it rather as one of the principal value of democracy, which is to harmonize relationship as opposed to, as to let them fester and then eventually destroy mutually.
Right.
That's the whole idea. So that, no, I think that a tactile sensibility of, which is basically what's happening with profiling right now, I mean, a tactile sense. So remember that McLuhan also said that statistics are touch.
Yes.
That numbers is...
Numbers is tactile.
Right? Numbers is tactile. So basically, the big data is a tactile environment in itself. A potentially, it's virtual tactility, in fact. So I think that we are on the right track. It's just that exactly how to formulate how it already all works and how it would all work out globally on the global scale. That's the issue.
Now, how McLuhan said the global village is not a pastoral environment. That was a projection of literate biased people.
Yeah.
I'm detecting that many people project democracy as a pastoral sharing environment. It's not. Real democracy is argumentative and vicious that when it was in the 19th century. Remember what the newspapers were very...
Yeah,
aggressive and violent.
Agreed. And of course, a bit of what you're saying about the protest against Trump is of that nature.
Yeah.
But again, as you also...
But they're not laying out platforms. They're just going, fuck you, Trump. That's what's on the signs.
Yeah.
With that, you couldn't do that 40 years ago. You weren't allowed to swear in public, back then.
Fuck you, Trump.
That's all they're saying.
That's his language. Come on.
Hey, I just got an idea. Do you know why they're saying fuck you, Trump? Because people are, they know all the positions of Trump. They've seen the videos. They've been on the forums. They hate him and all this stuff. I just realized that these signs are summary positions based on all the data they've been processing for 6 months.
They're votes.
Yeah, the election has been going on for 6 months now.
Well, it actually will. I mean, that's what I, well, it, stupid. Again, we were talking about it before, saying it's all entertainment, man. Basically, it doesn't amount to very much.
That's right. It doesn't amount. It does. The media has to make a significance where there really isn't any, and they're not allowed to analyze and point that out. But they must make significance out of nothing, what McLuhan called the sound and fury. It's been most of the 20th century. And people can't find where the significance is. Where is the significant information? What is the important event that you can put your ethics onto?
Yeah.
That's a big floating, drifting, multi-bodied frustration, is that people are looking for a place to put their significance, their sense of significance or purpose, and they can't find that place. So then they fall back and, okay, there's an election going on. Okay, I'm going to get very involved with this. I'll put on my passion about it. There's always a constant putting on going on. People are forced to be so many different kinds of actors that it's a big fake, a lot of what people are doing, because it's the conversation of the day. It's just, we're doing an election. Okay, let's do that for 6 months.
No, it is true. But then again, there is a long tradition of discussing or not discussing politics in the family. There's all kinds of
things. Now, do you, when the chairman of the Democratic Party, the Republican Party, comes out or has a press conference, and he's very serious, he says, oh, we got important issues here, do you take that seriously?
No.
You don't. Nobody does. Nobody takes the dour, serious face, the croaker face, seriously anymore. Nobody believes it. Because they know that they're going to, as soon as they leave the press conference, they're going to go kill somebody or have a mistress or shoot up. We see that in the House of Cards, our documentary entertainment. You see it in Homeland. People's they don't have any ethics really in the way they live today.
Although there would be no reason not to take them seriously, even at manifestation like were happening yesterday and the day before. With Merkel, hugging Hollande over the 300,000 people that were massacred at Verdun.
Yeah.
I think I feel more sympathy for those 300,000 people than they do.
Yeah.
And that's not saying a whole lot, because, of course, if I think about it, it is an absolutely horrifying thing. But then, as somebody says, between 300,000 and one person, there is not much difference when they're dead.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
It's
very strong to think about numbers, but basically they're dying in such ways is absolutely unacceptable. And that's what they said, but do they really, are they behind their words? I don't take anything I see on the news seriously, except when, if really, something has really happened. Like, I think now Fajula has been retaken by the Syrians, and I feel better about that.
Oh, man, that's funny. Yeah, I don't even know what it is. I'm not feeling better about that. I mean, I didn't know it was a problem.
I'll tell you, Fajula is the city that was held by the Daesh, by the jihadists, until yesterday or the day before, when they really were repelled. But it was the closest to Baghdad, and that would be very, very menacing for the government, for the whole of the country, which already is very menacing. It's already preempting territory from it, but the fact is they're losing. The Daesh guys are beginning to lose territory, which means that they are fightable. And once you know that they are fightable, people are going to actually do it. The Kurds have shown the example, and now the Iraqis themselves are taking the matter in hand. They are supported by the Americans and by the European alliance, but basically they're doing the job, which is preventing Americans from having to go and put their boots in the ground, which is what they had done precisely in Fallujah in the time when they were trying to bring democracy back to Iraq.
Right. Now, there's an improperly defined project. You can't bring... Which democracy are you bringing? And now Bush looks bad if you use the old terms. But if Bush had advisors where he could update what he meant by democracy, maybe you come in and have a different meaning for it, then he wouldn't look so bad. That's the problem. You're in the White House, you're immediately going to become a failure because you got to use obsolete language for that role.
Yes, of course. No, but they are cornered into their role.
Yeah.
But I think that Mr. Bush and Mr. Cheney could have been more elegant about it.
Oh, yeah. They, for some reason, were They were like the average American. They were indifferent to the... Do you know that Bush got in because he was indifferent to the information environment? His image was that he didn't read the newspapers. Trump's partly have a bit... You know, Trump's an interesting combination of Reagan and the younger Bush. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He's got the two of them in him. But the you had the super informed guy Clinton and Gore in the 90s, and people didn't like that, so they wanted somebody who, during a debate, and I think this is why he won in 2000, it was just a contender. At least he was in on it, and people thought he was too stupid up to that point. They made the same mistake they're making about Trump. When Gore, during the debate, took over and started talking, what's Bush doing? He's winking at the crowd. He's winking at the audience.
Yeah.
That was smart, because he's saying, look, I know this is a put-on, and he was ESPing to the audience, and I guess the people on TV saw it. That's pretty important, and Trump is doing an updated version of that.
Yeah. That's interesting. Very good. I may fade out for a while because I have to go off. I think let's keep on talking as long as it works. I have to go away from the house for a bit, and that's why.
Okay. So so McLuhan says you can't have ethics in electronic discarnate society. That's something that isn't talked about. You see, the basic points that when you understand the more subtle and apt points, not the fact a meeting was a message or there was a global village, you know, the really important points that he said that people don't know he said, if people use them more in their awareness, I'm all for that. You know?
Yeah.
And
I just figured out that I was getting off your signal. So hang on. Just stay there. Don't move.
Okay.
I'm just going to do a run and come back.
All right.
I'm going to be less than a minute. Ciao.
I'll just entertain people by reading Croker to you. Let's see. I'm going to continue that point. So he on page 177, Croker says, there are two key ways of thinking the future with Marshall McLuhan, technologically and ontologically. Now, I'm going to just check to see if there's such a word as ontology. H-A-U-N-T-H-A-U-N-T-O-G-Y. Ontology. Oh, it says it's a portmanteau of haunting and ontology. It refers to the state of temporal, historical, and ontological disjunction in which the ostensible immediacy of presence is replaced by, quote, the figure of the ghost as that which is neither present nor absent, neither dead nor alive. Well, that's pretty good. That's basically what we're trying to say. I'm trying to say that there is no present. And this seems to be working towards that. It refers to the state of temporal, historical, and ontological disjunction in which the ostensible immediacy of presence is replaced by the figure of the ghost as that which is neither present nor absent, neither dead nor alive. All right, that's a good word. So he says there are two key ways of thinking the future with Marshall McLuhan, technologically and ontologically. Technologically, we are living within the electronic universe, first theorized in all its complexity, speed, seduction, and violence by McLuhan's thought. Ontologically, everything today is marked by all the signs of full digital saturation. Information everywhere, connectivity pervasive, bodies augmented, perception illuminated, truth a purely phantasm.
I'm back.
I've been reading this awesome explanation of ontology by Croker after the tetrad part. So let me just finish the sentence. Information everywhere, connectivity pervasive, bodies augmented, perception illuminated, truth a purely phantasmagorical effect, perception coded by media feeds, attention fully wired, all this driven on by an economy specializing in the hyperproduction of uselessness. We have literally become post-human in the sense that subjectivity is now immanent to the laws of media. That peculiarly technological condition in which subjectivity is both precondition and object of the fully realized digital society. Now, I looked up ontology. Derek, listen to this. Ontology is a portmanteau of haunting and ontology. It refers to the state of temporal, historical, and ontological disjunction in which the ostensible immediacy of presence is replaced by, quote, the figure of the ghost is that which is neither present nor absent, neither dead nor alive. That's what I'm trying to say when I say there's no now.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very good word. I don't know where that definition came from. I don't think they're quoting Kroger.
No, it's a fantastic. I thought it was something that he might have picked up from Joyce, because it's a very Joyce. I mean, you remember the aunt and the grasshopper?
Yes.
Okay.
That's a good pun. The haunt. The
yeah,
aunt. The haunt.
The haunt and the grasshopper. But he obviously has read Finnegan's Wake too, and he actually, I think I heard him talk about it, and I can't remember what he said. But
I interviewed him in 2004 on a radio program. I brought up Joyce, and I said, how come you never used Joyce in Finnegan's Wake? He says, well, no, I'm interested in it, but I don't think he's read it much.
No?
I've never seen him use it.
It's such a Joyce and pun that, because what it is to me immediately, and Joyce and puns were never made in vain. In other words, it was always something to grab that was key into them.
Yeah.
And in this one, more than anything else, it's the haunting of ontology that's affecting every one of the literate people.
Yes.
Literate people are haunted. They know they're changing. They know they're shaking. But they're haunted by the continuity of their ontology.
And, you know, the tribal people, you know what they say? They interpret it in chemical body terms. He says, there's more of us now than you white people here in the United States. See, they interpret their takeover in physical body terms. Mm-hmm. They're going to outnumber the white guys. And they do this a lot in their Rotary meetings, Kiwanis meetings.
To tell you frankly, I was extremely interested, and I suppose it could be a sign of democracy in England, but that the mayor of London is called, I forgot his name, but he's clearly from a Muslim origin.
Right.
Yeah. And then you'll find this more and more. I mean, you know about Houellebecq, Submission. Did you hear about that book?
No, I don't know that.
Well, Houellebecq is one of the three or four most important novelists, and actually critical novelists. That too is powerful when you really get to the spot. But he is one of the most important French writer today, and wrote a book which I taught in my time at U of T called Les Particules Élémentaires, Elementary Particles, which was already about the relationship between simple individuals. You would love it, in fact, because it lacks particles. In fact, he's basically looking at people as part of a chemical relationship.
Yes, subatomic,
you might
want to
check though. Check that out. Huh?
Subatomic particles?
Yeah, to a point. It's a play on words, because he doesn't really go into the detail of any kind of chemical association, but he but to make a long one short, his recent success, huge success worldwide, in fact, is called Submission. And it shows that because of the attempt of the right wing to offset the power of the National Front, the Front National, Marine Le Pen, and and all that the very right wing extremist French, France to the Frenchmen kind of people. There's Donald Trump. It's a Donald Trump movement, but it's met because they're French. They talk a lot and it's very articulate.
Right.
Anyway.
Now, you're saying this is a novel about the mainstream right wing trying to get rid of the extreme right wing? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, it's a novel. No, it's not quite. I'm not finished. It's what happens in order to avoid the danger of the Front National.
Yeah.
The right wing people assemble and do elect as a minister of culture, a minister of education. They do elect one of the Muslim persons. And of course, what does a Muslim do? He starts revolutionizing the Ministry of Education, putting more Quran and God knows what other things that come in the traditional. And then, but he shows very cleverly, using precisely the whole structure of institutional structure of politics, but also the maneuvering in between the various parts of it, that eventually the whole of France has become Muslim. Eventually, that its submission is, you were submitted. The French are now submitted to Muslim rule.
Right, right.
And of course, it's an exaggeration. It's very satirical. It's hugely manipulative as well. But,
and it's all about the fear of the present over the last few years.
And it's all about the fear of the present. It's all about the era. And it happened before. That's the most amazing thing about it. It happened before the 13th of November. The book was published long before. Like, I think it may even have happened before the Charlie Hebdo.
Oh, yeah? So like 2 years ago, published.
I have to check that. But I mean, the guy really writes. I mean, he takes this. He feels the sense. Now talks about tactile. You can't. If you're a writer, you can't just invent that. You have to feel.
Yeah.
You have to really feel.
And you teach this book.
I think we do feel now.
You teach the book in your courses.
Not that one. No, the first one, the Particules élémentaires. And then he had to call another one. And I forgot the name of that. Platform, I think it was called, and then the third big one. He's written others, but the big ones are Particules élémentaires, Platform, and this last one, Soumission.
Right. In your magazine that you do with your partner, what kind of audience do you have for that?
Well, I'm trying to change it or enlarge it. It basically is, in my estimate, and I did talk with Maria Pia, and she sort of agreed that it's basically a visiting card. It's how do you call that? It's enterprise newsletter kind of thing, magazine for people in government, business, and culture, basically. And it's very much focused on also on advertising issues, and it is dedicated to print, not print. Only, but to print and media, to all the media, and within it, a large part of the attention is given to publicity and advertising. And we are supported by Google, by Facebook, we're still working on Twitter, but we're supported by local big association, the United Publicists Association of Italy. Things like this. So it's really a kind. And what I'd like to do is to say, yes, let's keep that. It's important because it's the network. It's a kind of a network of people in control. But let's also give it enough content that it can go beyond that network.
Mm.
And
what would that be? What's beyond that network?
Then it becomes basically my greatest competitor would be Internazionale, which is.
Yeah.
The journal, but Internazionale is not a real competitor. It's one that picks up all the better articles about the current news that one finds in various languages. It's a bit like Courrier International does it in France, Internazionale does it in Italy. It's actually very stimulating, very intelligent. It gets very often the very best article, and so do you get a feeling for what the world's thinking about this issue or that issue. So that's very good. And basically, what we're trying to do is do a single issue focus every time that actually has the same depth and the same attractiveness to people that Internazionale has.
Right.
So we're not competing, but we're trying to add something to it.
Yes, she values your McLuhan knowledge. She thinks that you can always put a unique spin on whatever you're going to examine.
That is true. That is true. I don't know where I deserve it every time, but it's true. And so it helps, but also for me, it's a medium of expression. It's wonderful to. I hate to have to write all by myself. It's just too tiring.
Right.
So I'm just too slow. And so it's much better to address an issue, have a few ideas that one really wants people to meditate or think about, and then have a whole lot of people who have their own and. Very often, every bit as good as yours, and sometimes much better. So one has to be humble about this.
Yeah.
But it's much more exciting for me to do that, and then it also is a fantastic way for a while of focusing on one thing. You know, very much like the Jihad versus Macworld was a long time focused. My next one, I hope, is going to be artificial intelligence, which, by the way, I hate almost as much as I hate golf. but has suddenly become interesting because now robotics is getting into it and the body actually is being mimicked and all that becomes much more. I have to give it a second look and a second thought. Yeah.
Okay. So now let's go back to the issue of what is democracy. I think we've run through a lot of different themes, and the now translate all that we talked about. We could have a quote from Foucault. How does that kind of thinking apply to the issue of democracy in the present election? I don't think it does. And it's a sign that the audience is thinking and talking. Millions of educated people are talking way beyond the dumbed-down level of politics. So I remember reading...
Wait a minute. No, if we're going to take it from Foucault, there's one thing we have to remember. If not, you have to know if you don't remember it. But... the basis of any social formation, institutional
power does not come from people. It comes from language.
That's what Foucault says?
Foucault says the order is the order of discourse.
Okay,
so it's
yes.
How you name things. The story of Adam isn't finished. How you name things is the way you see and structure, or how things auto-organize around the naming that series and correlations allow.
Okay, what if you can't name a process? Like, it's very hard to name where we're at today.
That's the point. That's what you and I have been trying to
yes.
do for two or three sessions.
And so Foucault
yes.
says you have to name it for it to be real or actual. That's why he died. He couldn't
mm-hmm.
name what was going on anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Croker is trying to name what's going on. And for most people, it's incomprehensible, right? It's too abundant of an inventory.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I like about Croker's style. He lists about 20 things in a paragraph. And then he says, but it may not be that way. Then he'll list another 20 things.
Very good. He really is.
It's a unique style.
It makes me want to see that book and get it as soon as possible.
Yeah, it looks good. It makes me want to reread it. I have to look at it again because now I know what hontology means. I mean, I never looked it up before for some reason. But the back to this point, so we can't name. See, remember Rumpelstiltskin, he got away with it if you couldn't name him, if you didn't know his name.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my tiny note chart is all swirling around the Rumpelstiltskin factor. And I claim that my four bodies, sometimes five bodies, depending on who you are and whether I bring the fifth body into it, is a proper naming of the situation. I have the terms, the jargon that you have to use. And I'm saying that McLuhan doesn't name it. He named it 50 years ago. He was the guy who caught Rumpelstiltskin. He named it. And then they tried to give him the Order of Canada and the Governor's General Award, and then they tried to take his tenure away. They didn't know what to do with this guy who successfully named Rumpelstiltskin. But the
he did.
He did.
Name that's it. Always the case with those poor devils.
Yeah. Rumpelstiltskin, he gets mad. He has a lot of supporters, and if you name him, you're not going to get away with it without some conflict. So we're trying to name this situation, and I'm saying that the only reason that there are elections is it's the Harry Potter phenomenon. The population sentimentally likes to think they can get on the same page. They want something unifying them. And so the election, that's why they have to have the election go 3 years out of every four. They talk about what's going to happen, and then they say, okay, now we're getting into the year before the election, so it's all about the jockeying and that. And then you get into the final 12 months, and then you've got a few candidates, and it's that. You realize how
and
much...
And nothing gets done in any institution.
Yes.
In Italy and France, in the United States and Canada, you know what? No, we can't decide it until after the election.
Yeah.
That's what I hear all the time.
Yeah. They
say, here I'm in an administration and I'm trying to look for permanent residence and you can't wait and you can't make a decision about this until the election? What is this?
No, that's the big alibi. We have elections so that because people can't decide anymore what anything's going on.
Yeah.
They really can't use the left hemisphere classifying function. They can use the right hemisphere of motion, turn on music, and bop around a bit. But really, we can't classify anymore. And so Foucault, when he says everything's discourse, well, it actually is now discourse.
Yes,
endless talking about what it is.
It is, but then again, the archaeology of knowledge of Foucault is entirely based on this notion of discourse. And how the discourse creates the functions and how the functions create the actions. And so that...
Do you know that was McLuhan's conclusion too? All media and artifacts were words. That was his final statement in his final years. His big discovery was, I realize everything, all technologies are words. And he would italicize W-O-R-D-S.
Mm-hmm.
That's the same point as Foucault's.
Yeah, it is. It is. Maybe he was influenced by reading The Archaeology of Knowledge. It could be.
I would counter that by saying, if you look at the media dynamics and you're sophisticated and you check out Finney's Wake or the most advanced knowledge, you will come to McLuhan's conclusion. And Baudrillard and Foucault and Derrida did. They were younger, but they analyzed things. They were a good perceptive X-ray knowledge, and they had to come to that same decision. Then they made their own idiosyncratic language about it. But I say that you come, that you and I can probably think similarly and agree on a lot of points because we've acquired the McLuhan perception.
Yes, I think so. I mean, that makes perfect sense. I mean, I can remember how I thought and what I thought before McLuhan and what
yes.
I thought after. And I could remember the previous one. That's all I can say. But it was very different.
Yeah.
Very different.
So that means that a collective consciousness is possible. If we all get on the same page, I'll study McLuhan, and everybody somehow had local monitors that test you whether you got it or not, and you really got it, then you'd have a society of ESP because everybody would have the same page. And I think that was what motivated McLuhan, is he saw that there was a new kind of Esperanto. It was happening right in the environment in front of it. You just had to name it correctly. And he was on the right track by saying, well, concepts don't apply here. You got to have percepts. There's not enough time to make a concept. Do you see what I'm saying? And then Croker says that's what he's doing. He says back in the 90s, he's making a language that he hopes people can use well into the 21st century. That's a pretty ambitious project to think that you came up with the language that you could do it. And what I find is Croker and I are very similar because we've mastered McLuhan, we've mastered things past McLuhan. You come to the same point. It's obviously we're drifting bodies. You can't deny that. It's like the color of the sky. It's blue.
Mm-hmm. No, I feel that is actually good news, that at least we find a
common perception.
A common perception and an echoing of that perception across the four people we're talking about, all of which have achieved a level of authority and credibility that assures us that we're not wasting our time looking in that direction.
Right, right.
But it's also true, I think, that it's still more of a direction than an arriving point.
Well, you can't arrive in it in the literate economy because you have to maintain your separate identity,
mm-hmm.
private property and everything that comes out of the Gutenberg galaxy. And that's why McLuhan said literate man can't – that's why the exploration seminar in the 50s failed. He says Western private identity will prevent agreement.
Mm-hmm.
But tribal people, they will agree, but they are being threatened by the digitization and the autonomization, the autonomy-creating situation right within their families. So the Japanese had this problem a few years ago. I heard about it on the news, that their sons and daughters wouldn't leave their bedrooms. They'd sit there for 2 years being on the Internet. And now you've got Internet addiction camps in China. So the tribalism that China might be proud of, they've been around for 10,000 years and they've successfully survived, they are being threatened by the Matrix, by the digital thing. It's not human.
How interesting. Didn't realize that they had already rehab camps for people.
Yes, somebody sent me a documentary, just a part. Maybe I'll be able to send it to you. They're all the kids, the parents send their kids to this boot camp.
Ooh-ah-ooh. That's fabulous.
Yeah, media fast. Yeah, that's what Marshall wanted. Marshall Law.
The martial law, exactly. Listen, big boy, I'm going to have to leave for a while. If you want to continue, we can do it later or but I need about half an hour now.
No, it's time for me. It's 7:15 in the morning. It's time for me to have some sleep.
All right, have a good one, and we'll recover. Tomorrow is way out. There's no question tomorrow I can't do it. I'll be busy every hour.
No, but we're doing good. We're on a roll. We're getting in every couple of days. Now, I just want to – Eric was interviewed in 1980 mm-hmm. in the Toronto Star about whether he could take over the Cochos, and he said this, if it was translated properly, he said Mao Zedong, his name has the same meaning as Marshall's name. Had you ever heard of that? You ever talk to Eric about that?
No.
Okay, I bring that up because we ended on the China note and how they're bringing in martial law. If you get a chance to ask Eric, ask him, what was the meaning of Mao Zedong's name and how did it relate to Marshall's name or whatever the idea was, if you see him? It's an interesting idea, but he's quoted as saying that in the newspaper article.
Fantastic. All right, I'll ask good old Eric.
All right. Okay. And whatever it was I said I'd send you, I'll send. I can't
all
remember
right.
what it is right now.
It was, but it was about this, about the kids and their internet addictions.
Yes, that. Okay. All right. Thanks a lot, Derek.
Okay.
That was good.
Bye-bye.